So I think it's my goal this afternoon. I think it's a little sleepy in this room. Not any fault of yours. I think it's something about the oxygen and the color, and I don't know. So I'm going to try to give a sort of colorful and mildly disturbing talk. But like Alex, I'm going to try to not say that the sky is falling, even though it may be that it is. Anyway, so this is just one of many visualizations like those that we've seen today. This one happens to come from Eve and Jim Stone and Charles Gammy, and it shows a density field in three dimensions, and of course the velocity field could equally be represented, as could the magnetic field, and all sorts of other wonderful things that we wish that we could measure for you in three dimensions, but alas, Chris, we cannot. Okay? So we can't do that. So Aki already made the very good point that one way to get around this problem is to try to do the forward problem where you actually create a version of what observers would see from a particular simulation or prediction. Before I go any farther, I want to pay homage to Alex, who makes the very good point that it's also possible to go backwards effectively when you're very careful and you choose a very particular statistic that's very well connected to a particular physical parameter, like the work that he was showing us this morning. That's not often a case in detail for when you want to look at lots of parameters. So we like to look at lots of parameters, and we is a large group of people who've been working on something called the Complete Survey of Star-Forming Regions, which importantly stands for Coordinated Molecular Probe Line Extinction Thermal Emission Survey. Now, the reason I read that all out, I'm not going to read the list of collaborators. Everybody there is important. The people in bold are actually here or are going to be here at some point. But the reason that the name of the survey is important is because there are many different ways to measure the same thing in a molecular cloud. And one of the points that I'm going to make today is that you and I have to be very careful to understand the details of what a particular kind of tracer of, say, density, okay, tells you compared with some other tracer of density. You might think density is just one number, and it should be if we could correct things perfectly. But unfortunately, we can't. And so this goes back to Aki's point, and you'll see in a minute what I mean. The other thing that's very important is you see here, this is that same a moment ago, and what it shows you is many different things. You can't really see them all from where you're sitting, okay, but importantly, there are some little red and blue smudges on here that if you were up close and saw it at high resolution, or all the millimeter and submillimeter peaks corresponding potentially to embedded sources in the Perseus cloud. The 13 CO green contours here show you what I will maintain is an evil representation of molecular gas, which is integrated intensity along the line of sight. So you're taking all the velocity information and compressing it. Okay, but that is something that's valid to potentially compare with, say, other measures of just column density rather than anything that has a third dimension, so like extinction maps or thermal emission maps from dust. Okay, and then you can hardly see it, but the color image in the background is actually a mid-infrared composite from C2D data, which is a survey that covers many of the same regions as the complete survey and studies the stellar distribution, which I won't talk about today. And then there's Barnard's optical image from 1927, in which, by the way, you can already see the very large and important H2 region created by a B star, which is right in here, that most people ignore when they consider the dynamics of all of Perseus, but we won't today. So what most people do when they want to look at the velocity information that's actually in one of these molecular line maps is they make these so-called channel maps. And so I can slide this around here, and I can do something similar to what Mark was showing you, because I can do it interactively this morning, where if I slide, you see the little slider at the bottom, and if I move that backward and forward, that's showing you stuff at different velocities. And you do get an impression that certainly there's an overall gradient in the cloud and that there's lots of substructure, but it's actually quite hard to see what's really going on in this so-called position-position velocity space. And so now I'm going to show you a new view of how to look at that, okay? And you're going to be confused, and you're going to think that this is actual three-dimensional data. Okay, Paola has seen this enough times. She knows why she's laughing. It looks like a three-dimensional molecular cloud. Do not be deceived, Chris. This is position-position velocity space, okay? So if I wanted to make the cloud there, come alive. Now let me get rid of all that silly 2D data in the background here, and let me go ahead and play with this. So here is Perseus. Let me pause this. I'll pause it as if I was looking at it from negative velocity. Okay, and one of the things I want to show you is look at this giant structure here. Okay, can you see my cursor on screen? Yes, okay. So if I turn that back to the plane of the sky, okay, so the dimension into the page is velocity along the line of sight. That's what you're looking at. This is now the plane of the sky view. And that big structure that I just showed you comes right across this blob, which is NGC 1333, which is a very famous cluster. And so if you look at this, you will actually see that that big continuous, tenuous arc of gas actually projects itself right in front and gives you the idea that there's some sort of bizarre, double peak velocity distribution in the middle there of NGC 1333. There's all sorts of other things. You can stare at this for hours. You know, you can see a hole created by an embedded star up here. You can see all sorts of weird velocity features in the middle here that turn out to be associated with the shell around the B star. But let's just say that this is jam-packed with information that's very hard to compare directly with simulations unless you apply some kind of statistics to it that you can also apply to the simulation. So that brings me to my point. Okay, so we, Aki and I and a number of other people in the room were at a meeting almost a year ago now in Ringburg, where there were a lot of debates among the simulators and the observers about, you know, is it competitive accretion? Is it a global infall? Is it this, that, or the other thing? And a lot of people were, you know, literally some were simulating apples and some were simulating oranges and some were simulating the seeds of the oranges and some were simulating the orange truck, you know, the delivery truck. And it's like, get it straight, guys, you know, talk about what it is that you're actually simulating. And so the most important thing is to say, okay, what is it that you're trying to make? So these questions about what size scales apply to what simulations and what observations are actually, you know, relevant to what particular physical processes, that's all obviously important. But what we did was we went back, and this is Eric Roslowski and I, and we decided to set up this online community of people who could discuss their simulations and their observations. And I'm very grateful to Mike and to Paolo for creating this CADAC thing, because you'll see in a few minutes that being able to sort of archive the simulations is a perfect companion to being able to discuss them. But what's a taste test, okay? So a taste test, the idea is that if you go to a restaurant and you eat something and you don't know the recipe for this delicious thing that you had, what do? You go back home if you're a chef and you find all the ingredients you have and you try over and over again to create the same thing. And how do you know whether you created the same thing? Well, you look at it, you smell it, and you taste it. You know, this thing here that looks like tomato soup could actually be a bowl of red paint, you know, but it looks exactly like what you had in the restaurant. So you don't want to do that. You have to actually taste it. And so I would say that a lot of these so-called taste tests are statistics that have to be carried out in the tasting plane, okay, in the observational plane. And so what we want to do is create a place for people to put ideas about those tests and examples of how they're applied, and also link that to places where people can get simulations and observations. And so I'm not going to go through this list. You've heard of a lot of these earlier today. Some of these tests are more inspired by the data, some more by theory, and I'm just going to talk about a couple of examples. Okay. So today I'm just going to talk about two examples, two particular, what seem like simple problems, but I'm going to show you the sort of observational vagaries associated with these problems. So one prediction that comes out of nearly all turbulence models is that the column density distribution overall, if you sample a large enough volume, should be pretty close to a log normal. And we actually find, using the complete data and making many adjustments for systematic biases in it, that actually the column density is rather log normal. And I just said tens of parsec scales because that's what the complete data applies to. Okay, so it seems like these clouds are in fact going to be simulated well by turbulence simulations, but I think we already knew that. And then the question is, of course, can we relate what we get in detail to physical parameters like the Mach number and magnetic field? And you'll have to wait a couple minutes to see that. And then the second point is about self-gravity. So we've heard today, you know, various roles for gravity at various scales and whether or not that's important. And one of the things that's always been tempting to do, but very difficult, is to try to figure out what structures in what is obviously a hierarchical molecular cloud are gravitationally bound and which ones are transient. And I'm not going to tell you today that we've done that perfectly, but we've made a first pass at doing it that I believe. Okay, and the key to doing it turned out to be to have a way to quantify the hierarchical structure rather than to break the cloud into pieces where every coordinate in some volume has to be in one and only one piece. Okay, so if you're staying, and I'm going to be here for another few weeks total, I'll go beyond these first two, and I would have talked about modeling scattered light in molecular clouds, which is something Paolo is interested in very much, and Jonathan Foster, who's also here, but I'm not going to. I would have talked about the effects of multiple temperatures along the line of sight and how one can or can't model those and how that puts an uncertainty on dust temperature maps and hence dust column density maps, but I'm not going to talk about that. And I would have also talked about the stellar distribution and in particular this problem about how clouds and stars potentially separate from each other and the bias that's imposed by people only measuring the stellar distribution that is actually currently projected on top of molecular clouds. We don't really know what happens to the other stars. But never mind. Okay. So, like I say here, my goal is to make you hungry. I don't know if I have time to do an interactive demo of this, but let me just show you that, you know, again, I should mention that the simulations, this site, this taste testing site, of which many of you have already signed up and are members, is not open to the public, only because that's the way the software happens to work. You have to just request to be part of it. It's just like CADDOC, and we'll try to link these things more obviously. It does not host simulations and things like that the way that CADDOC does, okay? What instead it provides is the opportunity for people to actually go and describe their own simulation. So here's there's a function called a write board, which is basically a editable page like in a wiki, only it's a little bit easier to edit than in a wiki. And we're supposed to be waiting a moment while it loads up the write board. I really do have a web connection, at least I did a few minutes ago. But I don't know that I'm going to wait. Huh. Okay, well, that's impressive. We'll just go here. Well, we won't. Okay, never mind. It does work, and, you know, there's always...
Sometimes.
Lucky me. Okay. Anyway, it does work, and so there's just a screenshot. Just in case it didn't work, here's one of Mark's simulations. There are these write boards that are already filled out about several of the simulations you've been hearing about today, and it goes on telling you what the purpose is, who submitted it, and then it goes on in varying levels of detail, depending on the person who submitted it, about the code and about the results and about the computer it was run on and all sorts of things you'd want to know. Okay, so Paolo and I started playing these games a few years ago with something called a spectral correlation function that, again, I'm not going to have time to discuss today. I'm just going to make a point here that in this funny, highly derived space, Perseus, which is what I'm talking about, is up here. The gray region was, at that time, the range that was possible to produce in Paolo's MHD simulations. Perseus up here was right at the edge, and the implication of this plot.
Could you give us at least some very vague idea of what we're looking
for? Sure, it's the time, it's the problem.
The
Sure. I'm sorry. I should have just like put a picture of my daughter here or something like that. But anyway, the axis label, this is the slope. This is how fast the spectra decorrelate with each other in a map, and this is the value of how correlated they are at a standard separation of one parsec. Okay. And so the implication of this plot was that not high enough Mach number had yet been simulated to match most of these clouds. What was important was this list on the left here that says that you need to project into the 2D plane of the sky, you need to do radiative transfer. It would be really nice if people would apply chemical models. This hadn't been done. Noise and the observing characteristics of the telescope are also all critical. Okay, so what about the column density distribution? So here's a plot from, again, one of each papers. And you can just see here, this is for a strong field case, a medium field, and a weak field. And you get these log normal distributions with slightly different means and widths. And there's this relationship that's supposed to be satisfied between the normalized density contrast and the width of the distribution. Well, let me show you what happens when you try and actually do that. So here's three maps of Perseus, okay? And the top one is extinction based on two mass and NICER. The middle one is dust emission, and the bottom one is 13CO emission. And you see they look vaguely similar, except you can already see that this one has, they're all to the same scale. This one has some blue, and the other ones don't. Well, let me show you what the issues are, okay? So for extinction, the errors are correlated with the extinction, okay? Because there are fewer stars there, and if you want to keep the same resolution, you actually get less certainty in regions of higher extinction. However, you can't read this from where you're sitting, but the errors are very small, so this is not a huge problem, okay? In dust emission, this is now a temperature map of the dust, and you see that there's this big heated shell, which you can correct for pretty well, but this issue that I mentioned before about variations in the temperature along the line of sight, and you still have to assign only one color temperature to each pixel, you can't correct for, okay? And then last, but certainly not least, if you look at the 13CO data and then you look at a map of the opacity, it looks exactly like the map of the data, okay? So you can try to correct for that, but only up to a point. So here are some plots that I actually showed last year in Ringberg, okay, where we started out just taking the maps blindly. This is now just integrated 13CO. The blue curve shows you the fit of the log normal to the two-mass NICER distribution here. You'll notice the IRAS was originally shifted over, okay? We can fix that. This is after 2 years of refinement. We can fix that by recalibrating the IRAS data so that they match the two-mass data as best as possible, because there is an unknown far infrared opacity in there, which we calibrated. And so that's the first paper that came out of trying to do this. I forgot to mention, by the way, that all of this column density study came out of a simple question that Eve asked me, what is the column density distribution in the complete guide, 3 years ago. So we've written, I think, five other papers, other than the one that says, what is the column density distribution? Okay, and here's why. Okay, oops, sorry. So here, the 13CO, certainly you have to go through and actually calculate the column density based on knowing the brightness temperature from the 12CO, et cetera. But this is kind of the best you can do. So this is looking pretty bad, okay? And in particular, you have a problem that CO is subthermally excited at low densities and that it's optically thick and you can't correct perfectly for it at high density. So you don't, in fact, get a log normal. You'll get the proper values because we've set the 13CO again to match the two mass overall, but you don't get the same shape of the distribution. So okay, you could say that this does give you something that looks like a log normal, except for the CO, which is quite bad. But then you could start worrying about the effects of things like this shell, which are shown again, it's a little hard to see here, but in pink and blue superposed. If you take out the shell, which is what we're currently playing around with, again, here's some blue points and some pink points, but these are the relations between the 13CO and the far infrared and the near infrared, the 13CO, and anyway, the point is that there's a lot of scatter that you cannot get rid of, okay, and that there are systematic biases due to the presence of the shell. And I'm going to go over the 1 minute because we started 4 minutes late, okay? So this is the current column density distribution, Eve. And you'll notice that the 13CO is still bad. You take the shell out, you actually make the agreement between the IRAS and the NICER map worse, okay? And if you want to see how does that, is that relation satisfied that's predicted for the log normal and the turbulence, here's the plot that should, the correlation that should exist between the square of the width and the mean here. And the points don't quite fall on it, but they fall on the range that's within the simulations. And if you believed these relations in great detail and you had enough simulations, you could actually potentially use this to say something about how strong or weak the field is and what the Mach number is. Right now, I'm not willing to do that. Okay. Then the last thing I wanted to show you is this business about dendrograms, okay, and that self-gravity actually matters. So here's a 2D map of a little piece of Perseus, L1448, which you actually heard Dick mention Zeeman observations of the green contours, again, are showing you integrated intensity. The lovely image you can hardly see in the background is one of these cloud shine images. Please ask me later what that means. Okay, but importantly, what you see is a big blob here and some structure. If you apply clump fine to that, again, this is the way these axes go, velocities going into the page, you break it up into all these little teeny tiny pieces. Okay, this is a different algorithm called dendrograms, which is a hierarchical structure tree that's not unlike what Houlihan and Scalo proposed many years ago, but now we have an algorithm that actually does this in 3D. And this is, we think, a much more realistic rendition of what's going on inside these clouds. Okay. So just to show you how this works and then show you the answer, let's say that you had a 2D density profile rather than the number of dimensions we actually have. What we're saying is that the way a dendrogram structure tree works is you go down at each peak until they would join. And then so the tops are called leaves, and then the next thing down is a branch. And then you do this again with the next peak, and when those would join, so it's basically about these valleys. Okay, when those would join, then you have another piece of the tree, and then eventually you get to a root. Okay? What clump fine would do to exactly the same profile is it would just keep lowering their contours down. When it gets to a peak, it'll go all the way down to zero. Okay, and so it would break this structure into just these three pieces, and this hierarchy here would be lost. Okay, so I'm about to get to the point here. So if we have this map, okay, and this is position 1, 2, 3, and 4, so that you can keep track. Here it is again. In the hierarchy here of the dendrogram, there are those blobs, okay? So they don't make much sense on the integrated map, okay? But they make a lot of sense in position, velocity space, and they make no sense in the world of clump fine. This is the important bit here, okay? The stuff that's shown in yellow has a virial parameter of less than 2, okay? Because we actually have the velocity information and we have the density information. We can calculate that for each one of these hierarchical structures. The difference between the purple, the gray, and et cetera has to do with, it matches the colors here, and it has to do with this branch root leaf business. The last important thing I wanted to show you is that we actually now can publish that information in 3D. And so this is a page, this is just a PDF file. This is a mock-up page from something you might see in Nature very soon. And here's that 3D rendition of the cloud. And I can just move it around right inside the paper. And you too can go to the ApJ or Nature or wherever in the near future and do that to a simulation or whatever else you want. And so let me skip to my last slide. Let's skip all that interesting stuff about clump fine. And I'll just say that the menu may offer something for everyone, but you should taste carefully to be sure you got what you ordered. Don't get the spicy chicken when you want the dehoisin chicken, okay? And then the other thing is something that's become very clear to me over the last year or so of really thinking about this, is that there's a big difference between a numerical experiment where you're not meaning to simulate reality and an actual simulation where you are. And so I think people should also be very clear about which one they're trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Alex?
You mentioned that in relation to tasting the taste, Robert Wood, the 19th century American famous scientist, went to the student's canteen once, and he did not like the soup. And he took from his pocket some chemical and put it in the leftover on his plate. And next day he came and with chromatograph and made a measurement and concluded that the soup is made from the leftovers on the plates. So the essence of that is there are two different complementary ways to study things. And if we can use chromatograph, Can they get several numbers from that? Well, chromograph in this case, spectrum, topology, the rate of energy transfer. We should use that. It did not produce us the recipe of the good or bad soup, because sometimes we need to know when to put the ingredients, and this would change the taste. But I think that the ways that we are approaching the problem is synergetic and complementary.
I agree.
Well, okay, two very quick comments. One is that I was interested in seeing that your 13CO column density PDF actually deviated in an interesting way from log normality, appearing to have more like a power law tail on the right. And I'm, some time ago we proposed that that could also be the signature of a different from isothermal behavior. So, what? I don't know. We need to. So that's one. And then the other is that the dendrogram thing is very interesting. It could capture this stuff that is at larger scales but still gravitationally bound. So that's of interest. But how do you quantify that? How do you use it in the quantitative way?
Well, what we're trying to do is, what we're trying to do is come up with some statistics. So the first paper just shows how this technique works and establishes that we think we can quantify which are the self-gravitating regions, and in the paper we state, you know, what percentage of mass above a certain threshold, et cetera, is bound as compared to unbound. But what we're interested in is coming up with interesting statistics for the branching ratios and what the amount of bound stuff has to do with the branching ratios, which will tell you something about substructure. But we haven't figured out a good way to do that yet, and Eric and I have been thinking about it for a long time, and if you'd like to suggest one, anyone, let us know.
Hey, Alyssa. When we tried calculating column densities out of that big torus map, and we also found challenging to get the column density. You'd think after 25 years of observing CO, we'd get this right, or 35 years. But we did find is for the subthermally excited regions, we found that you had to change the ratio of the 12 to 13 C.
Yeah.
If you didn't do that, then you would never be able to match the line ratios accordingly. And when you do that, we still don't get a log normal because the way we're breaking up the cloud. But the other point, comment I want to make is for this repository for simulations, whether it's at one of the CFA or at this CADIC, it would be very helpful to actually have a cube derived from the simulations. We all have our own radiative transfer programs to do that conversion. Some are better than others. And I think the one that like Paolo uses is probably the most the most optimum one to use. And if we could have a sort of a standard, data cube from that would be fabulous.
Clarify that. So the CADAC is actually a place to put simulations. The taste testing thing was never meant to be a place to put the simulations. That was always something that we had to figure out. So I'm glad that that's been done. But the idea of having tools and pointers to tools, CADAC will actually host tools like the radiative transfer code, right, Paolo? Ask me, could you, right? Anyway, in principle, yes. And then the taste testing thing is a place to discuss that and say, well, I tried this tool on this thing and I got this out.
Okay, hold on.
Just a word of caution about using dust as the correct answer. Because I wrote a paper recently entitled "Can We Trust the Dust?" and I know for a fact it will be ignored because it says there is a problem. I don't think. Yeah, no, but in general it will be ignored. Like every paper that says there is a problem will be ignored. And there we find that it's hard to interpret the power spectra of projected density of dust. It may look like a nice log normal there. Well, I don't know which one is the right answer though. Of course, molecular lines have a lot of problems from chemistry to, radiative transfer. But there seem to be problems with dust extinction. And now we have actually written another paper with Mika Juvela on cloud shine, where we compare not with the CO, but we compare dust extinction with the scattering, near infrared scattering. And we show again that there are artifacts, obvious artifacts coming out of the extinction maps. You really need to be careful with extinction maps. They're not the final, the best, the safest answer to anything. So we have to be careful. It's a great method, but you have to be very careful.
Well, I just want to say one more thing about this. I was talking to Eve about this yesterday, and the reason I showed you the sort of 2 years ago, 3 years, 1 year ago, et cetera, is because even just with our own playing of what should we include and what shouldn't we include, we can change what this distribution looks like. And what I didn't say in answer to Mark's question is that Jaime Pineda and Paola have written a whole paper now about the abundance variations within four seas. And that's not even the 13 seas, 12 seas so much, just the 13 seas to H2. And it's a mess. And so if you do this region by region, you'll also get slightly different answers.
Yeah, the last quick question.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment by analogy of work on the intergalactic medium, which has been going on not as long as this subject, but I think it's made some progress. I mean, the intergalactic medium is vastly simpler than your problem. We think we know the initial conditions, and there are only a few astrophysical uncertainties, and even then there are only factors of two or something like that. And yet we don't know yet how to make simulations that exactly match the data. We use statistics. There's a well-agreed set of statistics that we all use, basically the same ones in all the papers, be they simulation or data papers. And what we find with simulations is it's fairly easy to get simulations that match one or two or three statistics, but it's hard to get simulations that match all of them, right? And those differences can be really, really rather large. And something that was said earlier on today, which comes up exactly here, it's very important to use exactly the same algorithm on both the data and on the simulation. You do have to observe the simulation, which means the simulation has to have in it realistic errors and defects and things like that, which means you have to work with observers, because the simulations don't know what the observing conditions are.
As I said to Alex, I agree.
Okay, let's move to the next talk. Yeah, Mr. So, Pumitaka.